Monday. And friendly reminder, we have an exam a week from today. And three review sessions scheduled, one after class on Wednesday, Commons 315, Living Learning. So just leave here and move there. Thursday, I think, in Fleming, room 101, but I can't get confirmation of that. For some reason, three people who need to talk to each other are never in the office at the same time. And Sunday from 5 to 6:30 here. The exam is at this time, and you'll be divided that way. So if your last name begins with A through F, come here. If it starts with M through Z, come here. If it starts with G through L, don't come here. Go to Voti, room 105, and take the exam there. And for the second exam, it'll be a different group. For the third exam, the other group. So each of you will get a chance, two chances to take exams here and one somewhere else. And variety is the spice of life. Okay. Everybody had a good weekend studying? Yeah, okay. And are there questions? Probably not. Okay. You're really eager to get back to puberty. How many of you want to live it again? You all love puberty, remember? Yes! Puberty was fun, wasn't it? Oh, you had a question.
What non-environmental factors can speed or slow down biological?
What?
Non-environmental.
Non-environmental factors.
So, like, diet, you know, nutrition, production, body, what can slow down biological?
That's an interesting question. Did you all hear the question? No, you didn't. What non-environmental... What's a non-environmental factor?
Well, like things that wouldn't have, like food and how you, you know, the environment you were raised in, you know, the family that you were raised for, whatever.
Okay, I'm not sure I can follow the question, but the question is what non-environmental factors can speed up or slow down biological growth? And my question was, what's a non-biological, non-environmental factor if it's a non-environmental factor, it would be biological but not influenced by the environment. Am I understanding correctly? Well, the problem is that the non-environmental factors are biological, and the only ones that aren't influenceable by the environment directly are genes, and they also are actually influenced by the environment. But if it's the genes and not being influenced by the environment, then the rate of development is going to be set by the genes, and the genes aren't going to slow it up or speed it up. Did you want to answer that question, I hope?
I was just thinking that emotional trauma or emotional situations...
Except she's making it non-environmental. Where did the question come from?
I was talking to Talia.
You were talking to Talia. Talia! You want to answer that question? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
My process was that if it's non-environmental, it's within yourself, and it's not going to be able to adjust it, because your environment would adjust how you felt. So
Right. Okay. She's just playing with you. Okay. Thank you for that honest answer. Excuse me. I've got to do something here, and I'm trying to remember how to do it, which is to turn off that light, which is really obnoxious up there. Yes! Now I can see. There's a special spotlight sometimes. It goes right through into my visual cortex. Occiput. Okay, so let me address that question the way it was intended. As a study question, it's can you speed up or slow down development? Then you have to look at whether or not you can do that and consider, as Talia is suggesting, environmental factors that might speed it up or slow it down, and anything that is going to impact it is going to be an environmental factor unless it's something biological that doesn't come from the environment, and I'm at a loss to think of what that might be. If you're going to talk about slowing up or speeding up or slowing down growth, then you have to start with, and there's a bit of logic here, you have to start with a baseline. And that baseline is a combination of your genetic growth pattern and whatever environmental influences have already caused it to deviate from an expectable growth rate. Okay? So your genes give you a pattern. It may be very fast, it may be very slow, it may be in the middle, it may be fits and starts, spurts and plateaus. We all inherit a pattern, a basic pattern for biological growth. And then what happens to us as we accumulate experience, or as we experience trauma, as we experience malnutrition or great nutrition and lots of sunshine and living at sea level, you know, all of those are going to affect the expression of the growth pattern that's genetically set. The question, the study question is, can I then speed it up or slow it down? In other words, can I introduce some factor that's going to speed it up or slow it down? And yes, I can do that. I can speed it up. I can slow it down. There are many ways to do that. I can malnourish you. I can delay puberty by several years. I can introduce non-biological males, if you're female, into your household. I can give you a stepfather and three stepbrothers who are a little bit older than you, and you will mature more quickly going through puberty, specifically puberty. So there are lots of other things that will speed up or slow down growth. So when you take it just as a general question, lots of things will speed it up or slow it down. The speeding up is harder to find examples for. Slowing down is very easy. Okay. But restricting that to non-environmental factors makes it... can I have non-environmental factors? Yes, the question is, if a child, and particularly thinking about a child, goes through a particularly traumatic experience, such as losing parents, in general, stress affects development, but the specific effects it has may be to increase some aspects of biological growth and to slow down others. It depends on, again, a genetic pattern for how you deal with trauma and how much support you get in dealing with that trauma. Certain parts of the brain may have their development slowed down by traumatic experience. As far as we know, the research on that's a little iffy. It's hard to get the research and it's hard to interpret it. But one take on it is that certain parts of the brain don't develop as readily or quickly as they might if you're experiencing severe and chronic stress as a child. Speeding up development, emotional stress during the middle childhood years is likely to accelerate the onset of puberty. One of the body appears to be trying to responding to stress, to ongoing stress, by getting ready to be independent. That's a pop psych interpretation of it. And it's the stress associated with having non-biologically related males that causes the acceleration of puberty. There are non-stress related explanations for that, and that's a factor that we use in getting fowl, for example, to mature and get ready to lay eggs. Put the rooster in with them, or even let them just see and hear the rooster, your chickens will mature, and then they will get ready to lay eggs, which is their equivalent of going through puberty. So we do that in order to speed the growth of many different domestic animals. Yes, one of the studies includes having a male adopted into the family older. If you grow up with the male who's not biologically related, for example, if you have an adopted brother who was adopted when you were very little or when he or she, no, he, the brother, was very young, then you don't see the impact, at least in the very few subjects that have been studied. It seems to be the middle childhood experience of having the biologically related male who is mature. So we're talking about older stepbrothers, older stepbrothers or older adopted brothers. That has the effect. So if they're littler than you, that doesn't make any difference. But if they're mature, and being exposed to pubescent or post-pubescent males during middle childhood accelerates your experience, your pubertal rate. Right. Okay, I don't want to go too far on that one. It's a very interesting and important question because it raises the necessity to think about how the genetic growth pattern is influenced by experience. And that's a fundamental question in this unit. How are the genes expressed and what influences that expression? Genetically, you have a range of potential that is included within your genes. It's for anything, range of height, range of growth rate, range of ultimate weight, body mass, bone density, and all of those things are provided for you genetically, but with a range of possibilities. And it's the experience that you have in your environment that determines where, in fact, you end up. Because you can't have a range of bone densities or a range of heights. You end up a particular height. And that's the expression of your genetic potential. But how tall you are depends on the influence of the environment and the experience that you have in it. Okay? So that's a very important point. The genes give you that potential. You're going to be somewhere within that range of potential. And the specific place you are in that range is going to depend on the experience that you have. One of the study questions is a trick question. Can you make somebody shorter or taller than his or her genetic potential? And the answer is no, not without cutting off the legs or putting inserts in someplace, not without surgical intervention. Because if you get to a particular height, that is within your genetic potential. And we'll run into that question in each of the units. You can't do anything outside your genetic potential without technological interference. Okay. Yes? The issue is whether putting somebody on the rack and torturing them by stretching their bones. There are, at least in animal studies, there is the possibility of lengthening bones by stretching them. It's a small amount, but it's the bone's response to the stress and the trauma of being stretched, and the stretch has to be applied in the right places. But it also interferes with bone growth, so you end up with distorted bones. And I don't know that anybody has done that with humans. I don't know of any research, but that's just not my area. There are studies of trying to accelerate growth by administering androgens, particularly testosterone, or growth hormone. Because people aren't growing fast enough in childhood, and they get up to be 14 or 15, and dad wants them to be a basketball player, and they're not 5 feet tall yet, so they administer testosterone, and that kicks off the growth spurt. And that used to be fairly common. And sure enough, you kick off the growth spurt, you get an acceleration in growth. One of the things I learned very early in my career is that endocrinologists generally don't know what the fuck they're doing as they're administering hormones to pubescent kids. I've worked with endocrinologists who happily, after you present them the evidence, acknowledge that they don't know anything about normal growth. So they treat the abnormalities and assume that they're creating normality, and typically they're not. So I like endocrinologists, but one of the fun things, if you're tempted to do that to your kid because you want the kid to be bigger, one of the fun consequences of administering testosterone that we'll talk about in a minute is epiphyseal ossification. Right. What does that mean? It means that in the growth centers of the bone, growth stops when you administer testosterone. It stops slowly. But the cool thing is, in trying to get the growth to happen, you accelerate it, but you also cause it to stop prematurely. So there's a long-term study of boys. It's typically boys that we want to be taller. The sexist thing in our society. Long-term consequences are that they end up an inch and a half to 2 inches shorter than they would have been if you left them alone, because you close off the growth in the long bones. I love that. Having been one of those kids who could have gone to the endocrinologist, I was 5 feet two going into high school. My brother was 6 feet tall going into the eighth grade. We'll talk about that in a minute, too. The specific function is bone growth, because the bone growth centers are specifically responsive to the hormones that increase at puberty. I don't know about other organ growth. I don't know.
When you talk about environmental factors, my brother's 6'5". I'm 5'4". We're 2 years apart. We grew up in the same family. Did all that happen when it was in the womb? Or which environmental factors would affect? We come from the same parents. We have the same genes.
Yes, but in height, you have two The example is her brother's 6 feet five. He's 2 years older. She's 5 foot four. Okay, so you've got a 13-inch difference. It took me a little while to do the math. It's okay. You have a 13-inch difference, but at least half of that difference is the standard average difference between male and female in our species. That difference is about 5 inches. And then you have the fact that both of you are representing the range of genes that are possible within your family. And that range may be very, very large. And the range may be very different for females than for males. Okay, so because of the Y chromosome that the male has and the X that he doesn't have. So the genetic potential may be quite different, but it may overlap. And he's expressing maybe the high end of that potential, and you may be expressing the low end of that potential. And isn't difference wonderful? Diversity is great. It's really wonderful. And as Lithgow said in the video, diversity is part of what keeps the species going. Just think of all the places you can go without bumping your head. That's when he's chasing you down the alley, it's important that you can duck in places where he can't go. This is from my own experience of having an older brother who was much larger than I was. There were places I could go when he couldn't. Okay, let me put all that in context of talking about puberty, which we were doing. And see if we can make a little sense out of that. Let me first put up this classic overhead. And let me just show you that part of it. Okay. I didn't do this on Wednesday, did I? No. Okay. No. Try that. Now that I hit the wrong button, so I've totally messed that up. That's what I want. Okay. I did a part of this, but I wanted to show the rest of it. If you just chart the height of kids as they go from infancy to or birth to their adult size, what you get is the blue curve for boys, the dark pink for girls. I didn't make this one. Okay, and what you see is that they are the same size and they have the same growth rate. Average. Average. Doesn't mean that one kid isn't going to be much bigger than another within the same family. But the average for both males and females is the same. Their body proportions are almost identical up through childhood. The two sexes are not very different. Puberty differentiates the two. And what happens is that the girls begin a growth spurt and they grow faster. So they are, in junior high school, on average, taller. And that leads to all those wonderful pictures of the boys and the girls at the eighth grade dance, you know, dancing. They can't dance cheek to cheek, so they're cheek to shoulder, or in my case, in seventh grade, my girlfriend, you know, fun. It was fun to do this. Yeah. Her unfortunate last name was Little, and she wasn't. And she was an early maturer. And she was a wonderful person, and we got along great, except, you know, she could put her chin on my head. Then the boys start to grow about a year and a half to 2 years later. And they end up taller. Why is that? They started later, so they're taller when they start the growth spurt. And they grow longer for a longer period of time, and on average grow more quickly than girls did. So the end result of that is that we end up, on average, taller. Someone has pointed out, a feminist researcher has pointed out, that girls have the experience, I won't call it an advantage or disadvantage, but they have the experience of being taller and more powerful than the boys in junior high school. And this is important. And it's important because boys then spend the rest of our lives compensating for those 2 years of being inferior. We spend the rest of our lives trying to dominate women because we suffer during junior high school. The girls are smarter than we are. They're more verbal than we are. They know things that we don't know. Anyway, okay. And I just want you to know that interpretation comes from a woman. Okay. But here's another way to look at the growth spurt. And this one I did draw part of. I don't need to draw it again because I've already done that. This is the increase in height or height gain. And I started this one off, remember, by asking when you grow fastest. You grow fastest in utero. Yeah. 20 inches in 9 months. You'll never do that again, hopefully. So then you slow down, and here's the middle childhood plateau. Okay, this is 4 or 5, and you've slowed down. And you go through this period of relatively slow growth. It gives you a chance to accommodate to your size and your proportions. Then the girls start that spurt. The boys keep plateauing. When they start their spurt, they're taller than the girls were. They grow more quickly and reach their final height later. So this chart shows clearly the difference, the average difference between the female pattern and the male pattern, and helps us understand why the boys get bigger. Okay? So that's what we're looking at. Now, if you take another way of looking at it and just look at the changes that kids go through, this is from work by a guy named Tanner, who spent his entire career looking at physical growth across the lifespan. And what he did was combine data from several studies. These are mostly working and middle-class kids in England and the U.S., and they're largely Caucasian. So what he did was look at stages of breast development, progress of pubic hair, the height spurt as it happened, and the occurrence of menarche. And there are a couple of things that I want to show. What he did, this is pubic hair from the very beginning to the mature triangle shape and relatively coarse consistency of the pubic hair. This is breast from breast bud to mature. Mature on average at 15, and mature then doesn't mean size. It means that the nipple and the areola, the dark area around the nipple, are distinct, they're differentiated, and the breast tissue is what the biologists call dependent from the chest wall. So it's not just a protuberance, it actually, in Ann Landers' term, it jiggles when you walk. Ann Landers used to say, people said, my daughter's 12, she's got big breasts, when should she have a bra? She wants one now, or she doesn't have any breasts. Ann Landers used to say, if you can hold a pencil under it, you need a bra. Okay, so that's what 5 is. The breast has separated from the rest of the chest tissue. Okay, this is the height spurt beginning on average of 10.5, mature height by 14 or so. But what I want to point out is here. This is the beginning breast bud. Some girls starting at 8 in these data. Some girls not starting until 13. So there's a 5 or 6 year span in the onset of puberty. if you measure that by breast buds. And breast buds are almost the first thing, usually the first thing you detect, the first change. Reaching the mature size, or mature conformation, not size, from 13 to 18. What that means is that some girls are beginning the development of their breasts at the same age that other girls have mature breasts. The 13-year-olds give you the widest possible range. And they're in the same class in school. That gives us an indication of the variability of pubescent development. Here you have some girls having reached menarche at 10, 3 years before classmates have begun puberty. And so again, at 13, or in this case 12, you may have kids who are having children, and they are physiologically ready to do that at 11 or 12, 2 or 3 years before some of their classmates have even begun puberty. How anybody teaches junior high school, I have no idea. I love junior high school kids, partly because of the tremendous diversity among them. Looking at the boys, we see very similar variation, but one thing we can point out here is we can't point it out that way. Let's zoom a bit. Okay, just if you look at the height spurt, the boys are a year and a half to 2 years later. Okay. Breast buds for the girls as early as 8, testes 9.5. Again, a year and a half different. Okay, bringing the boys back into focus, maybe. Okay. Again, similar variation. This is testicular growth for some beginning at 13.5 when others have reached mature testicle size. Penis, a little later than the testes. The testes are what you're going to see first, except you don't, because most of us don't measure the volume of our testicles. I actually did a study when I was at the University of Pittsburgh in which we measured scrotal volume for pubescent boys. I have always marveled at their willingness to engage in this research, which was about the relationship between pubertal development and cognitive development, and they were fascinated by it. So you use water displacement. Yeah. A beaker of water filled to the top. And the first kid, the very first kid who volunteered for this study taught us a very important lesson. Warm the water. Whatever came out of the tap was a little disturbing. And since the response to being cold is shrinkage of the scrotum and pulling scrotum up toward the body to try to get warm, it fouls up your results. So you have to use constant, preferably body temperature water. Okay. Where are we? Height spurt. Okay, same lesson. You have tremendous variability. Some kids are completely through puberty before others of the same age have begun. And they're in the same gym class. And one of the issues for us in dealing with pubescent kids is to help them understand that that variability is normal, that it's genetically driven, that it's not their fault. They can blame their parents if they want. They chose the wrong parents. If they want to be early maturers, they chose the wrong parents if they're late. And development is not a competitive process. There is no advantage to being earlier or later. Although there is a good deal of research on that issue, some of which shows that early maturing boys particularly are at an advantage socially. They're more likely to be class officers, they're more likely to be star athletes, they get mentioned more in the school newspaper, all that sort of stuff. And unfortunately, teachers think more highly of them because they are more mature physically than their classmates. I say unfortunately because they are not necessarily intellectually or emotionally more mature than their classmates. They just look older. And teachers and other adults and peers are often fooled into assuming that your physical maturity is accompanied by your emotional or cognitive maturity, and that just simply isn't the case. Some kids who are really early maturers are really, really immature cognitively and emotionally. If you look long-term, at high school, being an early maturer is an advantage for the boys because they're bigger than everybody else and they are through puberty. But if you watch what happens earlier and later, being a very early maturing male is in fact a disadvantage when you're going through puberty and later in life. So it's a very important lesson, and I'll just outline it very quickly. If you look developmentally, the research that always gets cited is on high school. And it shows that the early maturers are at some advantage. That's because they're being compared to kids who are pubescent or even not pubescent yet. And they are at an advantage athletically, in teacher estimation. They can be the bullies. But if you go back to middle school and you look at these same kids, the earlies are now pubescent. And they are a mess. The others are prepubescent, and they're just chugging along through childhood and having a great time. And these kids are a mess. They have more anxiety. They have more conflict with their parents. They have more sleep disorders. They have more emotional disorders. They have more problems in school. They're more likely to be engaging in behavior that adults don't like, so they get disciplined more. And then if you go post-high school, everybody's post-pubescent. And the earlies no longer have an advantage. They may be riding a little bit of confidence that they gained in high school. That will disappear, and they won't show any advantage later. What this research can be interpreted to mean is that puberty is the pits. And the earlier you go through it, the harder it is. The more disruptive it is. Because the earlier you go through puberty, the less mental and emotional equipment you have to deal with it. And the people who are helping you deal with it don't want you to be going through it, and they're not helpful.
Yes.
Why doesn't this have anything about sperm on it? Okay, the question is, if the girl can get pregnant as soon as she ovulates the first time, which will be possibly around first menstruation, not necessarily. There may be a period of functional infertility when she's not ovulating, but that's not a valid birth control technique. If you've menstruated, you can get pregnant. And you can, in fact, get pregnant before you menstruate if you're a very early ovulator. Okay. So you got to be careful. Why don't we have sperm on the chart here for timing for males? Where would it be? Actually, we don't quite know where it would be, but for females, the fact that I didn't point out on the chart was that menarche, 99.5% of the time, happens after the peak of growth. So when you start to slow down, you're likely to be approaching menarche. It's extremely rare for a young woman to menstruate before she has stopped slowing down. Extremely rare. It happens occasionally, but it's very rare. So you can use this information if you're charting the growth and you have a kid who's concerned about whether or not she's going to menstruate or ever get mature, or whether she's going to be 6.5 feet tall. You can look at whether or not she's menstruated, whether or not she's started to slow down, and see what the relationship is there, and you may be able to give her some useful advice, or at least a prediction. For males, we did this research for years and years and years without ever collecting sperm samples. I don't know why nobody ever asked the boys to ejaculate. I just don't know why no researcher ever said, why don't you come in here and give me an ejaculation sample and see where it would be relative to the growth spurt. We didn't do that because you can't do that kind of research. It's not going to happen. You're never going to get that through the institutional review board that has to approve research. You want the kids to masturbate? I'm sorry, we're going to terminate your tenure, probably, if you propose that. We do actually have a couple of studies now, and the problem is that sperm may be being developed very early. As the testes start to develop, the spermatocytes are beginning to mature sperm, but when you have enough to be functionally fertile is a judgment call. So we really don't know. You would have to study ejaculate over a period of time, and I guess nobody's really interested in doing that. I'm sorry, I missed the last few words, which I think are crucial. Yes, it's possible for somebody post-high school to be going through puberty. What you would be typically seeing then is somebody who had a physical condition such as malnutrition. Traumatic events that weren't chronic would, yeah, you'd have to add up over time. You would have to be experiencing biological trauma, and that would include the stress associated with losing parents, but it would have to be repeated, and you'd have to be adding stresses to it. For example, a kid who lost parents in late childhood and then because of that began having other problems and was malnourished and had an eating disorder, all of those things, could potentially delay puberty quite some length of time. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me come back to the question. Yes. The question is, do some people never hit puberty? And the absence of the Y chromosome will do that for males. So males who have an incomplete, who have 45 chromosomes, and the one missing is the Y chromosome, will not go through puberty. And when we discover that, we take them through puberty by administering growth hormone and testosterone. Turner syndrome girls go through a limited puberty. They have one X chromosome. They go through limited puberty. And in both cases, males without the Y and females with only one X are infertile. So they're not going to, because of the chromosomal disorder, they're not going to create sperm or ova. But let me pick up on both of those questions by talking about when the pubertal growth spurt starts. And one of the interesting things that came to light in research a few years ago, I'm sorry that's dim. Is it dim for you? Yeah. Remind me to redo that. This comes from research that is mentioned in the text, except these are the data from a woman named Rose Frisch, a nutritional expert professor at Tufts, who was interested in the relationship between nutrition and metabolism and children's growth. And Rose had taken data from a number of longitudinal studies where kids had been measured every couple of months, and she was trying to sort out what allows you to predict when puberty is going to happen. And she already knew before she started looking at the data that age is not a predictor because of that variability. You have kids 5 or 6 years different in age, and you can't predict from what the child's age is when it's going to start the pubertal pubescent growth spurt. Height is not a predictor. Some kids go through puberty when they're very short. Some kids can be really, really tall. It turns out that it's weight. It turns out that weight is the predictor. So what Frisch did, and these are her data, if you look at studies where kids are different ages when they go through puberty, it turns out that even though they're different ages, their weights are very similar. For example, in Denver, in the Denver longitudinal study, all the kids grew more slowly than in the Boston longitudinal study or the California longitudinal studies. Why do you grow more slowly in Denver? Because of the altitude. If you go to Chile and look in the Andes, growth is even slower and puberty is later. So elevation, it's like trying to boil water at altitude, right? You go up 8,000 feet, try to boil water, your cake bakes more slowly. Everything has to be adjusted in your recipes and in chemistry because of the change in pressure. So it's not surprising that growth is also slower at altitude. But no matter the altitude and no matter the age and how quickly growth is happening, females start the growth spurt at an average of 68 pounds, 31 kilograms. Whether they're 10 or whether they're 15 when they reach that height, that weight. Okay? Boys, remember, are later, so they're about 6 kilograms heavier when they start the growth spurt. And the difference between boys and girls. We have to be heavier before we start the growth spurt. These figures of 68 pounds are within a very narrow range, and that's unusual for growth data. It's about the closest, narrowest range that we have for any biological event after birth. The maximum growth is the peak at about 86 pounds for girls. I'm sorry, I didn't do the math on the poundage for boys. 39 kilograms for girls, 47 kilograms for boys. Menarche, about 48 kilograms. That doesn't mean if you never get to 105 pounds, you won't reach menarche. The variability there is greater. And again, we don't have the how many sperm at what age, at what weight. We just don't know. The question is, how does obesity or malnutrition affect this? And in these studies, those figures are for kids who are within the normal range of weight. Obesity changes metabolism, and it's metabolism that is governing. That's what the hypothalamus is monitoring. The hypothalamus is monitoring your metabolic needs and your metabolic demands and your intake, and when it reaches a particular number of calories per kilogram per day, it's going to change the set points for the hormones that govern growth. And being obese will modify those. Being malnourished will obviously delay it because you're not getting big enough. And going to the question of trauma or ongoing stress, anything that keeps your weight low will delay puberty because it's weight that's important. So, for example, if you're starting to do athletics early and you don't carry any body fat, you will keep your weight down and you will delay your growth. You'll delay the onset. You'll delay reaching your maximum, which means once you do start, you'll be growing more slowly. And for females, you can delay menarche for years. And you can also do that by lowering your body fat all through your menstruating years. So if you're a female particularly, since females are the ones most likely to menstruate, if you want to be a ballerina, or you're a gymnast and you're keeping your body fat below about 6%, you're not going to menstruate. Runners go for years without menstruating. The general recommendation currently is that every year or so you stop training for a while, eat a lot of ice cream, put on some fat, and see if the system still works. But just from a personal example, my daughter was a runner and rower. And during the rowing season, how many of you are crew? Nobody survives crew. Anyway, she rode heavyweight crew. And during the season, crew is nice, it has fall and spring. And she would gear up for the season by doing a lot of running, but also eating a lot of ice cream. And before the season started, she would menstruate, and she would go into the season about 170, eat as much as she could put in through the entire season, and lose weight. And so she would start the season at 170, end the season at 140. While she was losing, she would stop menstruating. When she switched from crew to running, she went months and months and months without menstruating, and every once in a while she'd slow up on her running, on her training, so that she could put on enough body fat so that she would menstruate to make sure that the system was working. No, that's a good question. If you slow down the growth so it takes place over a longer period, and so your peak is not as high, you'll increase the length of time, but you're growing more slowly. So it won't have an impact necessarily on the ultimate height that you reach. It may have an impact if your testosterone level goes up enough to start closing off the bone growth. And that's what happened for the kids who got their acceleration. So let me give you an example of that specifically. And let me get the trauma factor here first. How many of you are wrestlers? Okay. Just one. Sorry. I just didn't want to scare you. Let me go back one chart. There's a little chunk here on the male chart that isn't on the female chart. which is the apex of the strength spurt. What that means is that if you look at the height spurt, you also have a strength growth curve. And while you're growing, strength is also increasing, but it's increasing after height, in part because strength is not just based on height, but on muscle mass. And muscle mass is following height for most of us. And this apex of the strength spurt suggests that you are strongest after you have reached the height and put on the muscle mass and coordinated the muscle mass with the ligaments and the bone structure. You've got to put it all together. You've got to integrate it in order to develop the strength. And strength is measured on the basis of the amount of force you can exert given your weight. And so you have to have a comparison. So given your weight, how strong are you? Wrestlers know this. After you pass a particular weight and then continue to grow, you're going to increase your strength. And the longer you grow and the more mass you put on, the stronger you will get. If you're looking at somebody who has cut weight, dropped back to a previous weight, the trick is to cut weight while maintaining your strength. You do that by cutting fat and cutting water, and the balance between weight cutting and strength performance and coordination is a very delicate one. But the reason you cut weight is so that you can hopefully, by luck of the draw, wrestle against somebody who's the same weight that you cut down to, but he just got there. And he's going to be weaker than you are. So that's why athletes, particularly wrestlers, cut weight. They want to wrestle against somebody, since it's in weight classes. You want to wrestle against somebody who's roughly the same weight, but is younger than you are physiologically. You'll have the advantage. If you look at the growth patterns of wrestlers who started in high school and are very serious and get scholarships for Division I schools, look at their growth patterns. They grow slowly. And they have a long period of growth. Okay? Because they're still cutting weight through college. What happens for them is, one, they develop eating disorders, body image problems. But the other thing that happens is the hormones keep developing and the long bone growth gets shut off, and they end up in adulthood shorter than they would have been if they had not wrestled. So they are a different example of delaying growth past the point where testosterone is going to cause the long bone growth to slow down or stop. Okay, let me get through about 10 more minutes of stuff here. And the stuff I want to get through is the chart that you have. And I've run out, so there are 300 copies around here somewhere. If you have 4 or 5, give them up. Does anybody not have one? How many of you don't have one? Okay, if you have an extra, there are a couple of people who need one. Thank you. Okay. First question. Do you have to memorize this? Answer, no. Okay. I created this because I kept working with endocrinologists in graduate school and in Pittsburgh who didn't know how normal growth happened. And the funny story is, I wanted to find out, because none of the adolescent development textbooks describe normal development. Just, you know, what happens in a normal case from the brain changes to the things that are going to happen that you can see. What are the consequences? And two endocrinologists, very distinguished, both of them, in two distinguished universities, referred me when I asked that question, where can I find information about the course of normal development through puberty? They both referred me to the same textbook, which did not, in fact, describe normal puberty. And when I pointed that out to them, they said, huh? And that led me, in both cases, to working with them in ways that eventually led them to realize that, gee, endocrinologists don't know what the hell they're doing. I'm happy to report that Fritz Kenny, the guy at Pitt that I worked with, ended up making his career out of studying normal puberty. And he's retired now, but he's one of the world's experts on normal puberty, because he was the first person to take two kids, one male and one female, both normal, and just simply look at what happened to them and do blood samples and hormone samples over the course of puberty and adolescence. He was the first person who did it. And he did it because this stupid psychologist came in and said, hey, tell me about normal puberty. And he referred me to the textbook that didn't have it. So in scrounging through the library, he discovered that there weren't any textbooks that described it. So I put this together to try to describe it. The focus is really messed up, isn't it? There are some differences in terminology, because people use different language for the hormones. Okay, but with this in hand, there are a couple of basic principles I want you to understand, but with this in hand, you can become an endocrinologist about puberty. So hang on to it and use it for your own children. You can use it when one of your friends says, gee, my growth is really funny. Why is that? And you can tell them. Puberty starts with the metabolism, and the hypothalamus monitors that. And when the weight gets to the right point, it kicks the pituitary. And the pituitary secretes a whole bunch of hormones, increases the amount of each of those that it secretes. Each of those hormones has at least one endocrine organ that it impacts. I left off growth hormone affects really the whole body, but particularly the growth centers in bone. Thyrotropin is called thyrotropin because it heads for the thyroid. When the thyroid gets involved, it increases thyroid hormones. They add to growth, cause skeletal maturation, the epiphyseal ossification that I mentioned of turning the cartilage into bone, laying down, well, maturing your 12-year molars and laying down the basis for your wisdom teeth, and some brain development. The adrenocorticotropin is called that because it impacts the adrenal cortex, cortices, you have two of them, right over your kidneys. And when they're kicked by the ACTH, they begin to secrete increased amounts of estrogens and androgens and stress hormones, corticosteroids. And the androgens from both males and females, your adrenal cortices do the same thing in both males and females. The androgens cause pubic hair, underarm hair, add to the growth spurt, muscle development, oily skin. Your zits are because of the androgens from your adrenal cortex. The skin gets rougher and darker, and the androgens contribute to the testicular enlargement. The estrogens that come from the adrenal cortex cause breast bud development, laying down of subcutaneous fat under the skin, and cause maturation, they kick off the maturation of the female reproductive system. And that happens in both males and females, except males don't have the female reproductive system, But they do have breast tissue, and about 30% of males at puberty develop breast buds. And sometimes it's significant, and sometimes it doesn't go away. Males also deposit subcutaneous fat, and so we get pudgy, the doughboy look, okay, that we all love. Okay, so the androgen and the estrogen are the same for both males and females, and they cause the same changes. What becomes important then is the other sources of androgens and estrogens. Estrogen from the ovaries, testosterone from the testes, and it's the gonads, testes and ovary, which differentiate male and female. You remember back to the sixth week or seventh week of embryonic life? The Y chromosome kicks the male fetus and causes, or embryo, and causes all those changes that render that embryo male. Now, the fact that it has testes become really important. It's not important until you get to puberty. But under the influence of the follicle-stimulating hormone and the luteinizing hormone from the pituitary, the testes start to mature. The two parts, the interstitial cells, which are creating testosterone, and the spermatic tubules, which are beginning to mature the sperm. The testosterone from the testes is added to the androgens from the adrenal cortex, so everything that the adrenal cortex was causing gets a double dose in the male because of the testosterone from the testes. So all of these androgenic effects are larger, the changes are larger in males. So we get hairier, we grow more, we grow faster, we grow longer, we get more muscular, our skin gets worse, our skin is darker, and those are the basic secondary sex characteristics that differentiate male and female in appearance. The ovaries are maturing, again, two parts, the Graafian follicle and eventually the corpus luteum after menstruation. And the Graafian follicle is producing the ovum, or maturing the ovum. It's already there, but they're maturing it, and secreting estrogen, which is being added for the female to all those things that the estrogen from the adrenal cortex did. So women end up with bigger breasts, more subcutaneous fat, so our body proportions are different after puberty because of the difference between the products of the ovary and the products of the testes. The estrogen is also affecting everything that is in that box, all the reproductive system of the female, and after menarche, the progesterone that's being secreted by the corpus luteum is causing breast tissue to mature and become functional, and causing the vagina to secrete the fluids that it needs to stay lubricated. So bring any questions about that on Wednesday, and I'll see you then.